This is the Talk About Wellness podcast with your hosts and Everside Wellness practitioners. My name is Courtney Handelin.
And I'm Tasha Schultz.
Tasha, other than a fun play on words, why tacos?
Well, just like a good taco has many different toppings, so does each person's path to wellness.
That's right. And both tacos and wellness are customizable for each individual and with each season. And it's totally okay if it doesn't look the same as the next person's taco.
Because it shouldn't.
That's right.
So we are excited to share our wellness knowledge and stories and tips with you in a fun, educational way.
So let's taco about wellness. Welcome back to the Taco About Wellness podcast. My name is Courtney Handelin, and today we are talking about the things that your mother never told you about menopause. And I have brought back one of my favorite guests on the show, Jill Zimmerman, one of our PAs here.
Hello.
Jill, thank you. Yeah. Do you want to, for those who haven't listened, and I guess I'll remind at the end, but we did do an episode earlier, actually in May of 2021. So you'd have to scroll way back. On women's health. And we had talked a little bit about menopause in there, but in this episode, we're going to dive a little bit deeper in that area of a woman's life specifically. But so for those who haven't listened, could you give our listeners a little bit of background on you and your expertise in this field?
Sure. So I have been a PA now for about 25 years, which also places me in those perimenopause to menopause years myself.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking from personal experience.
Yeah. I've always worked in primary care, and I actually did women's health solely for about 15 years of those 25.
Awesome. So well versed in this subject.
Yes.
And today's a very special day for you, isn't it?
Sort of. It's my happy birthday.
Yes.
My official birthday is at midnight between the 28th and the 1st, I guess.
Yeah. The 29th.
It's the 29th officially. Future, yes. Right? Yep. Yeah. Next year I become a teenager.
Yeah.
I'll be 13.
Well, thank you for sharing time with us on the happy,
sure.
happy birthday.
Thank you.
Okay, hold up. Before we go any further, we do want to give a quick disclaimer that this podcast is provided for educational and informational purposes only and does not constitute providing medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your doctor or other qualified health provider regarding a medical condition, especially keeping in mind that we're speaking in general terms and each individual is different. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something stated on this podcast. Neither Everside Health nor its employees nor any contributor to this podcast makes any representations expressed or implied with respect to the information provided herein or to its use. So like I said, today we're talking about taking kind of a more deep dive on menopause. Can you explain for our listeners, like, how can we define menopause, and maybe both in medical terms, but also I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about, like, in society, how it's defined.
So when we're defining that, it's the time of life when a woman's ovaries stop providing estrogen and progesterone hormones, and then the menstrual period stops. There's both natural and surgical menopause that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the natural is, of course, our own hormones start to fail. There's no other medication intervention, and menopause ensues. And then there's the surgical, which would be that for different reasons, people either have a hysterectomy with it, where they either have their uterus and their ovaries removed, or just their uterus.
Okay. Okay. And then what about, like, perimenopause? I know we talked about that in that other episode, but
yeah.
how can you tell us a little bit of, like, the difference? What does the timeline look like for peri,
sure,
versus menopause versus post?
And
how does that break apart?
It's very different. And so that it's different for everybody, I should say.
Okay,
not very
right.
different, but different for everybody. So perimenopause is considered to be the time that's leading up to menopause. And so that might be where you start to have trickles in of some of the symptoms of menopause.
Sure.
But you may still be getting a period, whether that be monthly or varied. Maybe then you go down to every other month, or
right,
it goes back and forth, and it goes back to every month. That can actually last up to 10 years.
Yeah, that's right. I remember you saying
yeah.
that in our other episode, and
yeah.
I was like, mind blown.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And for some people, again, so they, the average age, I'm going off subject already, but the average age of menopause is 51 right now in the US. Mm-hmm. And so there are people that are completely through menopause by age 40, as well as there are still people that are menstruating into their late 50s. Okay. And so it really has a huge span.
Sure.
And So the perimenopause can last 10 years, somewhere mm-hmm. within that sliding scale time. But that means that some people in their 30s can start to be experiencing some of the symptoms of perimenopause or menopause, some of those hot flashes or night sweats or right. changes in their cycles okay. and things yeah. like that.
Yeah.
So that can be already happening then. The menopause is considered when you've gone a full 12 months without a period, mm-hmm. I'll say without a medication intervention type okay. of thing, just sure. naturally that oh, you've right. gone the 12 months without a period. That's where it gets a little bit tricky, because then you are considered to be menopausal, but you're also postmenopausal because you've gone through the 12 months.
Yeah.
And or then again, postmenopause, I think people use for people who are years past okay. that menopausal time.
Sure. 60s, 70s.
Right. Yeah.
And beyond.
Yeah. But really menopausal and postmenopausal are the same
okay.
terms.
That makes sense though.
Yeah.
That it can be kind of interchangeable. Well, and sometimes yeah. I think it gets confusing because like I've seen all the words thrown out there, and
yeah.
for myself, I've been like, what is the cutoff supposed right. to be?
Yeah. One of the other things that I like to mention that yeah. your mother will not tell you
yeah.
is that if after you have gone that 12 months without a period mm-hmm. and then you get what seems like a period, whether it be light or whether it be just like I had a period, you do need to see your gynecologist.
Oh.
Once you've achieved menopause and then you get a period or you have vaginal bleeding, that is actually one of the only signs that we get for uterine line cancer or okay. endometrial cancer.
Okay, that's good to know.
And again, during my 15 years, anybody who came in postmenopausal with that type of bleeding, we would do a biopsy of their uterus and we would do an ultrasound, a sort of an ultrasound type mm-hmm. thing, and do an evaluation. Now with all of those patients, I'm going to tell you that of my 15 years, I'm holding up hands here, probably not quite a full 10 patients mm-hmm. that I personally worked with maybe had that. It maybe had the uterine cancer. So the okay. uterine cancer itself is not very common, but everybody who has that postmenopausal bleeding has to be worked up the same way.
Sure.
And so I probably saw somebody of those 15 years, if I averaged it out, I probably saw at least one person a week for it.
Okay.
So just to give you okay, an idea wow. yeah. of really how uncommon it is.
Okay.
But yet you still have, but then yet, unfortunately, I guess how common it is to have some bleeding postmenopause.
Right.
But important to seek
care.
So
it's definitely important to seek care. Yeah. It could be nothing.
Don't lose sleep. Right. More likely than anything, it's nothing.
Sure, but it's definitely worth getting checked.
Yeah.
Well, that's important information.
Yeah.
So speaking of like menopause and perimenopause and postmenopause, I wonder if we can back up maybe even a second and take like a bigger picture look. I've been seeing a lot lately and hearing a lot, maybe just more aware now that I'm in my 30s at this point, of like cultures are so different, right?
Yeah.
And how we like, not putting myself in the we, but how society like views yeah. menopause or even postmenopause and perimenopause, you know, like the different stages of like the midlife crisis and, yeah. and stuff like that.
Well, and that's what's interesting. I think that's why sometimes I become pretty passionate about wanting people just to be informed
yeah.
and giving them the information that, again, nobody may have told them about
right.
or that not even their girlfriends know about to spread that information. Because unfortunately, in our American society, menopause seems to be more of, I'll say, a joke.
Sure.
Or yeah. you know, the butt of jokes.
The butt of a joke. Yeah. yeah. Yes.
Or, you know, the roll of the eye or something that's looked at as almost being shameful.
Yeah.
Whereas in some of the Asian and Indian cultures mm-hmm. that actually a woman's fertility time is very well respected. But when they achieve menopause, then that's when they're believed to get some of their, like, I don't know, best brain power or their their powers, like better powers.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And just more like connected to the earth and
And more respected in their
wisdom.
Communities.
Yeah,
yes, wisdom. Yes. Thank you. I'm digging in the air for the word.
Yeah. Well, that's in quite a few cultures too that I've seen, you know, Native American cultures.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that our, like this society that we live in is not, it's not.
Well, and when you and I were just even talking about the podcast, you said, well, it's kind of like how we're treated even as women with our periods, you know, you have to hide your tampon walking to the bathroom,
right?
You know, and you have to secretly throw it out and nothing can show in your pants and blah, 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 and all this other stuff. Which is true. I mean, not that, and again, I laugh because I can't imagine walking down the hall just swinging a tampon.
Yeah, right.
But I think that's because I've been taught to keep that private and
discreet.
Yes.
And, well, we live in a man's world.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think that this is also why that, you know, a lot of people are embarrassed to ask questions about menopause because it is, you know, it's showing vulnerability that I'm aging and I'm going through this process. So that I think that that's where a lot of conversations aren't had.
Right.
I think we also talked a little bit about this too, is that in medical schools, is that they really don't give a lot of education. And I'm going to say education on the basic level for menopause. And so again, I think it continues to foster that kind of shunned area of discussion. The people that are menopausal specialists usually have gone above and beyond to help educate themselves or attend, you know, continuing medical education focused on it so that they could learn different pearls and things like that as well too. And so that I think also then fosters some of those difficult conversations because depending on your provider's comfort in talking to you or their basic knowledge, because to no fault of their own, they maybe have not been given a good platform of education on menopause. So they may, you know, poo-poo questions or shrug them off or just say, well, yeah, that's the way it is.
And because they don't know. They don't know. It's almost like its own specialty.
Yeah.
Which is nice, but also unfortunate, because then when you go to the doctor, you'd assume that they might know certain things, but unbeknownst to you, that's really like a niche area. Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know about that. You know, one time you had said too about how like it's not a disease,
right?
So that makes it tricky too for like for even for like charting and billing, I'm guessing, right? It's different.
Yeah. I mean, cause it can be more counseling than anything else. But but because it isn't its own disease, it's not or labeled as a disease, an illness per se, that then there's, again, there is still somewhat of a lack of information or education on it.
Which not that I'm saying it should be because it's not a disease and that's not how I would want someone to look at it. But, well, hopefully in the, you know, in part of this podcast we can help to get the word out about some of those things and help increase people's I guess not motivation but openness to be willing to talk about it confidence. That's what I was going to say. I know we've jumped around a lot here, but I wanted to bring back to an interesting point that you had written. Just like a little fact about menopause in your research. Only whales and gorillas and humans go through menopause. I didn't know whales or gorillas. That's crazy.
What happens, and what I read with that, is that a lot of the female animals will die after their fertility. But with the gorillas and the whales, they actually continue to live on after they've lost their fertility.
So I guess that would make me wonder, and I'm not expecting you to have an answer on this, but like in those animal kingdoms, is a gorilla who's gone through menopause, like how are they treated in that tribe? You know, and same for a whale, like in that pod or whatever they're called, like how are those whales treated differently?
The next talk.
Yeah, right.
Whales in menopause. Yeah,
I need to bring in an animal specialist. If anyone's out there.
From the zoo.
Yeah. That would be awesome. All right. Good ideas coming up here. Yeah. Let's see. Was there anything else in the culture aspect of it all that we didn't touch on that you wanted to?
I think that, again, just because people feel a little bit shame sometimes to talk about it. And again, a lot of times the answer is that, again, this is normal. Everyone goes through it.
Right.
Well, that's a hard statement to make.
Yeah.
Because it is normal and everybody does go through it, but everybody's symptoms can be 110% different.
Yeah. Well, like you said, like timelines.
Can be very different. I mean, there can be women that are 39, just married and now ready to start a family, and unbeknownst to them, that unfortunately they maybe will go into early menopause.
Right.
Or again, can be some people that are 48 and they're still finishing their family. So it's very hard.
Or 48 and not thinking that they can still have kids, just assuming that it wouldn't happen, but then it does.
Right. Yep.
Sorry, were you going to say something?
No, but it is, again, just that it's important to ask questions, and there's no question that's silly.
Right.
And hopefully you're not made to feel that way.
Right.
Yeah. When we talk about this, and again, we kind of keep going back and forth off subjects or skipping around. And I think, again, it's just because I do feel like that there's so much information to be out there.
Yeah.
So skipping past, I'll say, necessarily what happens, I'll say, scientifically to the body with the change of the hormones. Did we talk about that in the last podcast?
We did. A little bit, but we didn't talk about it, the hormone part, as detailed.
I'll try and be brief on this because I do want to talk about some of the other symptoms that can be unexpected. So the fun part is that in perimenopause, when you might start having some cycle changes, maybe all of a sudden now they're heavier, they last 7 days, or maybe you skip to a year, or not sure if you had too many blankets on last night, or did you have night sweats? Mm-hmm. And then it might be 5 or 6 months before it happens again.
Sure.
So a lot of that can be brushed over. And again, we brush it over ourselves because it just doesn't seem to happen. So there just isn't great testing either.
Right.
To say, oh, it looks like in 2.3 years, you are going to be definitely in perimenopause, and it looks like you'll be menopausal in 4.4 years. Mm-hmm. There's not an accurate test. There is a blood test that is called F as in Frank, SH, FSH. And that's the follicular stimulating hormone. Okay. So that is the hormone that kind of pokes the ovaries to ovulate. So when the ovaries no longer want to ovulate, it keeps throwing more and more hormone on it. So that FSH level goes up when we are menopausal.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay. And so that is a blood test that we can check.
Sure.
But here's a fun fact. I've had patients that have gone 6 months without a period and you check their FSH and it's elevated, maybe, low to moderately elevated, but then all of a sudden 2 to 3 months, they come back and they have a couple periods.
Okay. They're regular again.
Yes. And I jokingly say that's when the body has found a storage of estrogen in a closet they forgot they owned.
Sure,
and so all of a sudden those hormones kind of come back and there you are, you're still in perimenopause. So that's why we kind of do that 12 period rule, kind of looking at it that way. If somebody's FSH is moderately elevated, if they haven't gone the full 12 months, I may give an educated guess that they probably are going to go that full 12 months.
Okay.
But still important if they have any vaginal bleeding during that time to, again, come on in or see a gynecologist at that point. Mm-hmm. So that is one test that's out there. But like I said, it's not a predicting tool. And somebody can have hot flashes, night sweats, and be skipping periods, but their FSH may come back normal.
Right.
That doesn't mean that then they're not perimenopausal.
Right.
It just means that we caught their hormones on a good day.
Right. I'm guessing the timing is that could fluctuate a lot too.
Yeah. And this serum test is a fairly good one. Doing measurements of your estrogen and progesterone by a serum or a blood test, it's not great because it just shows us a moment in time. Mm-hmm. It's almost something that you would have to do a frequency of testing, which would be horrible throughout your cycle to kind of get an idea. There are some providers that have worked and to educate and train themselves to do some more, I'll say, naturopathic testing. Okay. It's a dried urine spot or it is saliva testing.
Oh, sure.
But it's something that, again, you do some of these
like multiple samples
that then you send in. Of course, insurance doesn't cover it because it could give us a lot of good information. There are some good resources that I would give a shout out to Monica at MD Custom RX.
Okay.
So she's a PharmMD. And so she has done that education piece. I worked with a number of patients with her. Mm-hmm. And so there is some earlier testing there, but again, because it's not easy and because you have to be specially educated to understand it and interpret for your patients, mm-hmm. it isn't just readily available.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess too, like, I mean, I'm sure there are reasons where it would be really helpful to have a specific answer of like yes or no, like yes, you're in perimenopause. But probably generally speaking, it's more like validation, mm-hmm. right? Which mm-hmm. I guess you can probably just validate yourself if you just have a few of the symptoms of like, well, I've probably started perimenopause and it's maybe going to be a long road ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's always good to ask any female relatives that you have what their journey was like.
Yeah.
Because even though you're a female and you look like your mom, maybe your insides take after your dad's sister
right.
or your dad's mom.
Yeah.
And so it's good. Now, again, some of those older generations,
they're not going to want to talk about it.
They're not going to want to talk about
it. Right. But I guess you also like, you don't know unless if you ask, right? So this part of our goal here is like making a shift there where women do talk about this and ask those uncomfortable questions and get okay with being vulnerable with each other so that we can support each other and build up and make a shift in culture. I have big dreams, don't I?
Yes, I do too. I share those dreams with you.
Yeah. So what about, I guess let's talk about the basics first of like, maybe, well, let me put it this way. How can we prepare for menopause, for perimenopause and menopause? Like, what do we need to know? What are we not talking about that we should be?
So some basics, again, I think that people would always say, oh yeah, I see weight gain with menopause or perimenopause. Some of it is weight gain because our metabolisms change just mm-hmm. as we age. It also can sometimes be how we carry our weight. Like you may not actually see a weight change. I'm making air quotes.
Right.
But yet physically you feel different in your own clothes.
Yeah.
So when the hormones change, when we start to have less of that estrogen and progesterone, we have more of a dominance of testosterone, which mm-hmm. is a male hormone. Mm-hmm. And so we tend to, as females, we usually are going to carry more of our weight as being pear-shaped, well, maybe more in our hips. Mm-hmm. But as we lose some of that hormone, sometimes then our body weight shifts that it becomes more apple, like mm-hmm. a man who, if you think about, carries more of that weight in that belly area. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, it's real. It's frustrating, but it's real.
Yeah.
And so some people do gain weight. Again, metabolism changes, things like that. Some people really don't gain weight, but their bodies change, mm-hmm. you know, in how they're carrying their weight. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And so again, routine exercise, healthy eating, you know, all of the basics of every probably podcast that comes down is to be aware of that. So that's one thing. The pelvic laxity or the urinary incontinence that can come with maybe post pregnancies or mm-hmm. after carrying pregnancies or as we age. Sometimes again, if we have more of a predominant weight in our belly, and so there's a heavier weight that's pushing down on our pelvic area. Our entire body gets affected with aging and with gravity. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the skin on our face, mm-hmm. you know, or our hands or things like that, but our entire body does. And so I always used to tell patients in talking about any like a stress urinary incontinence, like where you sneeze, laugh or cough or something like that. and that they would have a little bit of urine. You know, maybe they're not having a ton of UTIs. Their skin isn't breaking down from having that urine exposure. You know, they haven't had a terrible accident, anything like that. So the problem with that is that we as a society shrug that off as being normal.
Right.
For women.
Right.
And it's not normal.
Right. Yeah.
It's common.
But not normal. Yeah.
And so again, it always depends on how are you living with that? Mm-hmm. You know, and so pelvic support is important for our entire lives. And I did mention pregnancy, but I'm also going to say that women who never have a pregnancy, gravity and age still goes with them.
Right.
So yeah. We still have a change in that a pelvic cavity, and our pelvic area is really just all muscle. Mm-hmm. So if we are not using those muscles, mm-hmm. they can become relaxed, and that can, again, bring on incontinence. I'm speaking of urinary incontinence, but guess what, ladies, you can also have poop incontinence.
Yeah, right.
Again, something your mother won't tell you.
Yeah. And a road that you don't want to go down. Right. Probably.
Right.
Yeah.
And why depends has yes. a whole aisle dedicated to itself. Yeah.
Right.
So that can happen. So those Kegels that maybe you were once taught or yeah. somebody had mentioned, those are very important. Mm-hmm. If you are a young woman and struggling with incontinence, come in and talk. Let's get you to be with a pelvic physical therapist. Mm-hmm. There are also modalities that, and there's lots of things. We've got Kegels. We've got, yeah. there could be, topical or insertional hormones pelvic wise that can help. There can be these things called pessaries. Did we talk about pessaries the last one?
Maybe we talked. I know we talked about pelvic floor stuff for sure.
Okay. So
is that the thing where you put it inside? Yes. Yes.
Okay.
We talked about women playing a video game.
Yes. Oh no. Yeah. That was a pelvic physical therapy. But a pessary is a round flat object.
Okay.
That's kind of a heavier rubber, if you okay. will. And it usually has like a center fill in it. So if you think of like a ring with mm-hmm. a thin membrane in the inside,
okay.
You usually will use a little lubricant to insert it. Or you can use some hormone, and you insert it as if you were inserting like an OB tampon, one of okay. the tampons without yeah. a string or yeah. an applicator. And so what it does, and the pelvic area, again, what your mom doesn't tell you, our pelvic area is like a reverse baggie. Mm-hmm. So you can't push something too far. It's not going to go into your right. your cavity of your abdomen or anything like that. So what this pessary does is then it tends to kind of open up and pop into the place and holds, basing on your pubic bone, mm-hmm. and kind of holds that pelvic area up.
Oh,
so some people will use those on a daily basis. Some people might use them when they're jogging, because when they jog, they have that urinary incontinence. But if their bladder's held up,
okay,
that then maybe they're not having any of that urinary incontinence.
Wow.
So when I first started in OB and I knew of pessaries and placing them and da, 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 and things like that, I, in my mind, was like, pessaries are for old ladies. That was just my association with it.
Sure.
And so I apologize to anybody if I don't want to offend anybody, but oh my gosh, pessaries can be so helpful.
I bet.
And again, not surgery, not, right. you know, with that yeah. can have a complication, not something that's a hormone that maybe you shouldn't be having because of family history of X, Y, or Z,
right.
or different things like that. So they're out there. And I don't know right. that people really know about that, or that, again, it's available to somebody who might need it at 32.
Yeah.
Versus yeah. having to wait until, and this is the other thing, ladies, if we're not helping our pelvic laxity, as we're aging, it is going to continue to relax. Now everybody ages at a different pace. Mm-hmm. So I cannot tell you how many numerous times in my OBGYN, office hours is that I had a woman come in mortified that she had a hard lump at her vaginal opening.
Mm.
And again, you can imagine that panic.
Yeah,
we all right. kind of, I always tell everybody, our fingertips are smart. So, you yeah. know, they're going to detect different things. And truly what that was, it was that their cervix had actually, the muscles had relaxed enough that her cervix, which is usually high within the vagina, mm-hmm. had relaxed so that it was now basically at the vaginal opening or protruding.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that can happen. And nobody, right. I mean, nobody
no
knows that.
That.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you can be mortified. And again, there's the pessaries, there's mm-hmm. surgeries, there's mm-hmm. all these different things that can help that out. Again, we talked about the pelvic physical therapy. The other thing I started to talk about, but didn't go down, and just because so many of my patients have never heard about this, is that in probably, let's see here, probably 2014, I'm going to guess, in the aesthetics world. So we're talking about the Botox world, the face filler world, things like that, the laser skin therapy. They started in Europe and working on lasering different parts of the body and skin, because again, as I said, our whole bodies, everything ages. And so there was developed actually a laser and a radio frequency treatments. And I'll break those down a little bit in a second. But what they do is just like what they would do for the outside face, is that they are treated into the vaginal and vulvar area. So the outside lips, and then also inside into the vagina.
Okay.
And just like they can do a light skin resurfacing on our face or our hands or things like that, they do the same thing in the vaginal or vulvar area.
Okay.
And it's without hormones. Most of them are three treatments, it's about a month apart for the three treatments. What we have found is that even though there is just barely, it's not even a millimeter of damage that happens. But what we have found is that then that calls these happy helpers, these cytokines that help to kind of repair the area.
Yeah.
And so for somebody, for somebody who might have either pelvic laxity, again, not those ladies that have the hard lump at their vaginal opening, but somebody maybe early in the changes.
Before that. Yes. Okay.
Or vaginal dryness. I didn't even talk vaginal dryness. No, that's what this is all about. Yeah.
Okay. But so this will help with the, like, you're having some urine leakage.
Yeah.
Or vaginal dryness.
Yes.
Or which we'll circle dryness. Back around to that in a second. Okay.
So that can help. Of course, because because it was kind of brought in through that aesthetics world, I would say that conventional providers have had a hard time looking at it, because they're thinking of it being a beauty promotion, which is a whole nother thing that I could go down the road about, that we can't consider our bottoms to be beautiful, but anyway, but they think of it as more of a beauty promotion than a medical treatment.
Sure. It's cosmetic.
Yes. Yeah. More cosmetic. But I'm going to tell you, and I have to circle around vaginal dryness. It's going to happen. It's going to happen across the board to everybody. Now, when it happens to you, it's different.
Sure.
And so for some people, they can start having vaginal dryness as some of their first symptoms of perimenopause.
Oh, right.
For some women, they don't appreciate or have problems with dryness of their vaginal area until postmenopause.
Okay.
And then it breaks into another level. Is that for some patients, they just have problems with vaginal dryness, meaning that intercourse becomes painful.
Sure.
And so that's why there's different lubricants that can be out there and can be helpful as far as with intercourse. So some people, that's the capacity that their dryness goes. Mm-hmm. Some people can have such significant dryness on in their vaginal and on their labia and their vulvar area, that it's painful for them to even wear like leggings or jeans or different things like that. And again, just think about, we're here in the middle of winter and I've got, dry cracked corner of my thumbs. Right. That happens on the bottom. That can happen on the bottom.
Terrible. Oh man.
And then there's also a situation where that there can be so much dryness. It's called an agglutination, and that's basically where the skin almost dries onto itself.
Together.
Yeah. And so again, I don't want to scare anybody, but vaginal dryness, it's going to happen. It's going to be at some level.
Right.
Again,
and no one tells you about that.
No one's warning us. Yeah. And that there's effective treatment. You don't have to suffer.
Yeah.
So again, circling back to some of these aesthetics or these laser and radio frequency treatments that can happen, is that in my OBGYN career, I had a number of patients who were at that level that they were using, lots of hormones on their bottom, topical, insertional, then still maybe using a topical lubricant that's safe within the vagina area. Our vagina area is also our most sensitive area. So we can't just use our Curel and call it a day. So there has to be certain products that you can use. And they were still suffering, that they, either had to, you know, stop having sex and intercourse because it was just so painful because they could barely even walk because they were so dry. Yeah. And so they actually partook in some of these laser treatments.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, a firm believer. And I've had a number of patients that I have talked with them about it and that they've appreciated that information, that that they have gone through and done the procedures and have had a very good successful outcome. Now, again, those procedures, just like anything else, is that we continue to age. We continue to age at different levels. So just trying to get that information out there again, too. So usually it's three treatments a month apart.
Sure.
Then they usually recommend that you do one treatment a year later.
Kind of like a maintenance.
Maintenance. And then they might recommend again that you repeat all three treatments the final in like 2 years. Mm-hmm. Again, everybody ages differently.
Sure.
You know, if you're the dry of the dry, and now you might be able to go 5 years before you end up back at that same spot that you were at. So that's important to know as well, too. And again, of course, like any good medicine, it's not covered by insurance.
Yeah.
Generally in this area, when I was looking, was that it was probably about $1,800 for the three treatments. Many places do accept your
HSA,
your health savings account for that. So just so that you're aware. And then the other thing is that you look at some of the risk benefits is that some people can't use estrogen. Estrogen is also a great moisturizer for the bottom,
right?
But it's something that you have to use consistently in order to achieve that. And again, not everybody wants to use estrogens. Not everybody can. Mm-hmm. When you're using vaginal estrogens, it still is going to absorb into the body, but it's going to be very minimal, different than if you were taking like an estrogen tablet.
Sure.
So vaginal estrogens can be very, very helpful.
Okay.
But there's also a cost with that. Mm-hmm. And again, I haven't necessarily checked the cost recently, but like all good medicine for female sexuality.
Yeah.
It's expensive.
Right.
And so, you know, you might think that $1,800 sounds expensive, but it might be $150 for your 3 month supply.
Right.
Of vaginal estrogen.
Yeah.
So
$1,800 might last you longer.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that is good to know. It's going to be an investment, but it sounds like it might be worth.
Yeah.
Life changing.
And they do have a new treatment that just became FDA approved.
Okay.
I'm going to list a couple names. We're going to have some of this as information.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's something that's called Emsella. It's Emsella. And that one is now FDA approved for pelvic support therapy for men and women.
Okay. Wow.
So of course that one gets FDA approved.
Yes, because men can benefit from it.
Sorry, being biased, being snarky. And that one is where it's almost kind of like a barrel chair, if you will, like almost like an office chair, but barrel shaped. And you just actually simply center your bottom on the chair in whatever clothes you're wearing, as long as there aren't any metal strings or metal pieces.
Yeah.
And then that's what you do. You sit, I think it's for like 28 minutes.
Okay. And what does it do?
What it does is that it basically, shocks is probably the wrong word. Sparks your muscle. So it's basically like doing, what did I say? Like 11,000 Kegels. Like,
oh, wow.
In 22 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is something that you'd go to like an office a provider for.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do have some resources for some locations. What I do suggest is that some of the vaginal laser and a radio frequency laser, again, does a little bit of micro damage. A laser is something that can, like cause an abrasion or something like that. So that's more of what the laser does. The radio frequency is a high heat frequency, but it also too, the high heat can damage the cells. And again, the cytokines come in. So that's the difference between those two. So there, some of the common ones that I know that are in the Waukesha or the greater Waukesha area are Femilift, Mona Lisa, Thermiva, V-Lace, and Diva. Now I do, if you're...
There's quite a few.
There is. And many of those are also within a urogynecologist office or a gynecology office or somebody who is a trained gynecologist. And if you haven't had that conversation about your pelvic laxity with your GYN and haven't been given a grade or any other diagnosis or things like that, it's important to be evaluated because again, we're not all the same. So this isn't going to be the solve for every single person, but it could be for many people. And so it's important to have somebody, I think, who is, has experience looking at bottoms,
right?
And being able to direct you of like, no, I think you have a yeast infection here. Let's treat this first. And then let's see how you're feeling.
Right.
You know, versus paying $1,800 and,
and not needing something that you don't really need.
Or getting vaginal estrogen and you don't necessarily need it.
Wow. That, I'm trying to just wrap my head around all
that. That's I just gave a
fascinating new information to digest. I love that.
Another great resource for, I think, all things pelvis, menopause, and sexual health. There is a unique store in Madison, Wisconsin that is called A Woman's Touch. It is nothing short of a sex shop. It is run by a physician and a sex therapist.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the store clerks are all very intensely trained. It's a very welcoming, if you will, area that they had years ago. We had, when I was in OBGYN, we actually visited the store and they kind of took us through. And so they are as mindful in their store to set up that something that is common to our eyes to see is set out in common areas, whereas things that might perhaps be offensive to some people or alarming or embarrassing for somebody to see, that they're very mindful that then you, those are in like, shelves that you would have to turn away from or turn around.
You have to seek it out.
Yeah.
So for someone who's maybe a little bit more reserved or I can't think of the right word, shy or like not super comfortable with that kind of like when you think of like sex shop, if that makes them uncomfortable, this is a place to go for like women's health. Things.
And they do cater to all sexualities. So I always tell patients, I promise you will giggle and I promise you will blush. But they have such great resources. And actually for those that are a little bit timid to maybe go into the store, they have a wonderful online service.
Oh, that's nice to know too, especially so, for any listeners that are stretched out a little farther.
Or can't get there during the store hours. If you have, if, say you're doing online investigation or and they have tons of blogs and just lots lots of teaching pieces. And they also have their own vaginal moisture program with using lubricants that they can walk you through. There's printed information. But it, they are just such a great resource. They sell a number of, I'll say, high quality lubricants. So lubricants, people can use lubricants with dryness, with intimacy, or sometimes they can use that safely on their bottom, just like we put face lotion on, like a moisturizer. So it's a nice non-hormone moisturizer too, just like we would put hand lotion on. It would still need to be reapplied daily. You know, that type of a thing, but some people will use it that way. So that's what lubricants are. And again, I'm telling you, the vaginal dryness and menopause, it's going to happen, you know, across the board. So that's a good resource. Those lubricants that are in your standard Walgreens, Target, things like that, they're just not great. They can get sticky and tacky after a while. Some of them want to be warming or cooling, and that's just like peppermint or cinnamon. Vaginas don't like that. So that's where I always direct people then to even shop online here and look at the lubricants, call the store if you have any questions. If whoever's there can't seem to answer a question for you, then they will simply take your information. And until they can find the person to answer for, you'll get a call back. So again, they're very supportive that way. The lubricants in their store are not any more expensive than things that you would buy at Target or Walgreens. But they're just better quality, much better quality. So anyway, so I highly encourage everybody to go there. Maybe not on your work computer. It might get blocked or you might have to talk to HR. Definitely, take a look there. Again, oodles of great information there. So A Woman's Touch. So wrapping up with other symptoms of menopause too, is that There can be the sleep disturbances, hot flashes, night sweats. Mm-hmm. Again, we don't have markings on how we're all going to behave that way. Right. Some things are easily treated, like with sleep. Some people do okay with just a little Benadryl at night to help them. And some people need more prescriptive medications. We touched on this on our last
podcast. We did. Right? I think we even actually, and I'll just say this for listeners, we even went into, you had given some like therapeutic dosage recommendation, again, like general recommendations for things like the black cohosh, evening primrose, I think you talked about too.
And Astroven, those are kind of the standards that have been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Sometimes again, too, as we're going into our late 30s and early 40s, sometimes progesterone, which is like a mother hormone that breaks down in our body, that can also be helpful, particularly that one for night sweats and sleep.
Okay.
And again, there's, when you look at menopausal products and things to help, there's 10,000 things to choose from,
right?
Because everybody is so different.
Yeah.
And so that's why when you go to that aisle and you're like, whoa, there's so much, what do I do? Because everybody responds differently.
That makes sense. I would guess too, in general, just taking a look at your sleep hygiene or bed evening habits, like bedtime habits, like that's probably worth a look too, just to make sure you're doing those things
in a supportive way. And then it also goes to other lifestyle things that we trickle down. You know, did you get decent exercise that day?
Right.
You know, things.
Move your body.
Yes. Yeah. You know, did you have a lot of sugar that day?
Right. Caffeine intake. Hydration.
You know, the just even more carbohydrates. Wine for a lot of us ladies and perimenopause, menopause is a trigger for sometimes those hot flashes and or the night sweats. Mm-hmm. So sometimes seeing, you know, gosh, that was a really bad night. Maybe trace back the day before, you know, did you have a clean diet that day? You know, did you go out to eat? You had one or two glasses of wine, you know, something like that, that you might be able to start to find maybe something to avoid or something to include in your diet. Soy can be helpful too. I think we touched on that the last time a little bit.
We might have. I don't know. I don't recall that.
Yeah. And sometimes you do have to be careful with how much soy you're taking in, that there could be a link to some cancer.
Okay. So can we talk about that a little bit? Because I remember like in college nutrition classes, there was talks, and I don't remember exactly. I wish Tasha was here because I know she would remember this detail. Yeah. But there was at that point, it was like, soy can really lead to breast cancer. And if someone has a risk for breast cancer, they shouldn't have soy. But then recently I saw some articles on the, you know, on the contrarian of like, oh, actually soy is preventative for cancer.
You know, you're right. And I think one of the hard things is that some of us don't include soy in our diet until we read it. And then we say, oh, okay, now I'm 51 and soy can help me as far as with my hot flashes or night sweats or my perimenopause symptoms. So it's more of a concern, at least from what research I've done. It seems more of a concern if you do a later in life sudden increase of soy versus if you've had soy supplementation throughout life. And so I think what they were comparing is that they were looking at Asian societies that have more soy naturally in their diet, that they tended to have lower breast cancer risks. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so they were trying to figure out, well, how is it preventing in this population, but we're cautious in the other, another population.
Yeah.
And so that's right now what their thought is that, so, you know, again, everybody should, I would say, don't not use soy, but again, start slow and start maybe including that in your normal diet at this point, no matter your age.
A gradual increase. Well, I think too, I mean, you know, looking at those studies, you know, what are the other factors that they looked at? Like Asian cultures generally are more active. So is there anything correlation with like the consumption of soy and activity, like your body breaks down things differently?
Definitely.
Not to push people more again, but like, maybe add in a walk, a 10-minute walk, if you're not already doing any activity.
And that is true, because actually the when we carry an excess weight, that actually converts to extra estrogen.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and that can increase risk for breast cancer or any cancer, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So can we circle back to one question that I have that I know I've had a couple coaching clients even mention this, but like, how does all this look differently? Or is there different things that you should know about if, let's say, you had a hysterectomy, whether that was at an early age? We talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but sure. Basically like a medically induced menopause, like what should you know about in that case?
So in the cases of hysterectomies, there's a couple different types of hysterectomies.
Sure.
And it sometimes depends on where somebody is within their change, right. You know? So, okay. So the different types of hysterectomies is one is that there can be just a removal of the uterus and they can spare the ovaries, leaving them. Mm-hmm. And then in that situation, you're going to still go through a quote unquote natural menopause because your ovaries, which are your estrogen stores, that they're still going to kind of fade away. Sure. And so you'll still have, even though you won't be getting periods anymore, you'll still have that. So you can still experience the hot flashes, the night sweats, all of that fun stuff.
Okay.
But it might not be immediate. Now, fun fact is that sometimes when a young woman has an ovarian sparing hysterectomy, she may, for the first couple days or week, have night sweats and hot flashes that tend to then improve with time.
Okay.
I jokingly say that the ovaries run away and they are hiding because they don't want to be surgically removed. So they shut down. but then they do, again, start to kick in just like the furnace. Yeah. And then sometimes those symptoms can lessen. If a woman has a hysterectomy in which she has her uterus and both ovaries taken, then that means that when she wakes up, she's actually menopausal.
Okay.
And so for some people that can be just a flip of a switch.
Right away. Start yes. All,
yep.
All the symptoms.
Yep. All the okay. symptoms that can happen with that.
Okay. And so symptoms are going to present, like, I guess it's hard to know because, right, because you can't live two lives, but generally the symptoms could be, they're subject to be the same.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And it's just a matter of if the ovaries are left or not. And okay. because I did say that there's three different hysterectomies, I want to just cover the third one too.
Yeah.
And this one has nothing to do necessarily with the ovaries, but there is some school of thought that with a hysterectomy that they actually leave the cervix mm-hmm. in the vaginal area and just remove the uterus from the abdominal area. Mm-hmm. For some people, it's a different school of thought. So it's a conversation to have if you're facing a hysterectomy or research to see if that's something. But again, that has nothing to do with hormones or with your ovaries.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? We didn't even talk about hormone therapy.
Hormone replacement therapy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, that's as much as we've given, you know, recommendations of vitamins, supplements, yeah, natural things,
kind of lubricants,
everything. Yeah. All the
which
natural
is
things.
Great.
Yeah. No, there is prescription hormonal mm-hmm. therapy that is available. And sure. I think that is, and yes, that can help. Vaginal estrogens can help with the dryness. Oral estrogens can help with the hot flashes and night sweats. Again, whether you get estrogen and progesterone sometimes depends on, again, if you've had a hysterectomy or not. So it's a conversation to have
sure.
With your provider right. and kind of looking at risk versus benefits as far as using that.
Well, I think it's cool that we have eaten up a lot of time just talking about all the things that are like kind of a little bit more natural, right?
Sure.
I think a lot of times women think about like, oh, I'm having all these symptoms of menopause and my only option is to hormone replacement therapy,
yeah.
like, right?
Right.
Medications.
Right.
But that was the last thing that we had mentioned
yeah,
about that.
Yeah.
Do we want to kind of wrap this up and can you summarize a little bit of like, how do our lifestyle choices play into this? I mean, I know it's kind of hard. There's no study that can be done because you can't live life twice, right?
Right.
For a particular yeah. woman. So
yeah.
it's a little bit hypothetical, but
yeah.
I'm assuming it's similar to any other thing, right? Where like, we don't know exactly, but probably the more healthy choices you make.
Yeah. Yes. And I would agree with that. Usually the more healthy choices that you make as far as, again, diet, exercise, sleep hygiene, all of that stuff that we previously mentioned,
mm-hmm.
that is all in theory helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, again, everybody is different.
Right.
So, you know, as much as I just even said, like extra weight in a woman can, and actually in a man can kind of convert to the estrogens.
Yeah.
You know, we could have somebody who has a high BMI mm-hmm. have a very mild perimenopause and menopause.
Right.
And yeah. then we could have somebody who's fit in a yoga coach that has a miserable time.
Right.
And that is hard to explain.
Yeah. And some of it's kind of like genetic. Luck of the, like how things are switched on or off.
Yeah. Right? And sometimes just our own sensitivities.
Right.
You know, so that can make a big difference.
Environmental factors.
Because even like with the hot flashes or the night sweats, I have, I've had many, many patients over the years that said to me, you know, I really don't, I'm usually a cold person, but then they would say, but come to think of it, I usually have to wear 3 layers in winter. And I guess this winter I'm only been using 2 layers.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, it's not necessarily again that all of a sudden your face is red, you start dripping in sweat, which can happen.
Yeah.
It's just somebody who recognizes that, oh, I don't need 3 layers because then I'm too warm.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Well, we touched on a lot of things, Jill, and I thank you again for your time. And I guess I'll just reiterate again that we'll put some resources that you sent. We'll share those in the show notes. But also that we have that, you know, Women's Health, What Your Mother Never Told You. That's episode number 14, which, like I said, was recorded way back in May of 2021. So you are going to have to scroll back. In that episode, we did talk about weight loss, some tips for menopause. We talked about screening recommendations and how to kind of know what's right for you and when you should meet with a provider on that too. We did spend quite a bit of time talking about pelvic floor health in that episode. And there was a couple of funny stories that you had shared in that episode too. So I think both of these will get some chuckles from women.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd also say, share this with the men in your life, right? Because as much as we need to be discussing with each other, you know,
opening these conversations.
Yeah, right. We need to open it up. And I guess across to all people, right?
Right.
The men, the people who are binary, all that, because then we can lift up those who are menstruating, those who are menopausal. We can lift them up and just have them feel more supported and like they can live within their cycle and the way that their body is trying to live instead of in this box that society puts us in.
Yeah. Shuns us to.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
And then if people have any questions, or maybe there was something that we touched on but didn't say much more about, can they contact you, Courtney?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Send us an email. Reach out to us on our social media places. And I would also say for our clinic eligible people, just give a call and they can probably schedule a meeting with me. Obviously schedule something with you if it's more of a medical thing. Or take notes and take it to whoever the provider is that you see and ask them these questions. Yeah. And I think, you know, the more people feel empowered and have like going with a list of questions to meet your medical provider, the more you'll get out of that appointment, even if it is, you know, not in the Everside model and it's outside and you have a short time, you can make more use of that time if you have like a structured list of questions. And at the very least, that provider will be like, well, we don't have a lot of time, we can schedule another appointment, or like, here's who I'm going to refer you to dive in deeper with that. Mm-hmm. I think, just take this information and be empowered. Anything else you want to add to that, Jill?
No, but I'll say talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah.
Compare stories and investigate and, you know, use the resources that we've given you.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you, everyone.
I'm so glad we got to talk about wellness today, Tasha. And thanks to our audience for joining us. If you have any questions from today's episode or a myth you'd like us to bust, send us an email. For our Wellness Center participants, if you'd like to dive in deeper on anything we discussed today, give us a call or an email and we'll schedule a coaching appointment. Everyone can find us on YouTube and Facebook at Waukesha Employee Health and Wellness. And be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from so you never miss an episode. Join us on the first Tuesday of every month for Taco Tuesday. Until then,
bye everyone!